This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Colin Liddell from Alternative Right. Colin, great having you back on.
Yeah, pleasure to be back, Robert.
We're going to be discussing David Bowie, but I thought before I got to that, I would like to ask you about your background as a journalist in the music industry. I know you wrote about that. You posted an interview you did recently, but I had no idea about that until I saw that interview.
Mm-hmm. Which one was that?
The one you did with Manticore Press.
Oh, yes. They interviewed me. Manticore Press interviewed me. And then that was a year and a half ago, I think. And then I reposted that to Alternative Right because of the Christmas slump in content.
How did you originally got started in blogging and journalism?
Well, my earliest forays into journalism, that was actually music journalism. And I kind of got into music journalism because, back in the day, my brother and one of his friends, they were heavily involved in music journalism. And it was a kind of a good way to get free tickets and free CDs and sometimes a bit of money. And of course, you could get to meet a few people. So I did a bit of that. And I was also very interested in music at that time. And like a lot of young people, I even had dreams of one day being a musician myself.
So this was in the 80s and 90s?
Yeah, the 80s and going into the 90s, yeah.
So when you got started in journalism, I guess it was after the peak of David Bowie's career.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think David Bowie, his career is mainly based in the 70s, the very kind of cutting edge music that the critics continue to rave on about. Most of that's in the 70s and a little bit in the early 80s. And then his career kind of goes into a kind of very confused patch. And he sort of loses himself, I think. And he's, you can see as an artist, he's struggling valiantly to get back to what he was in the 70s. There's actually some quite good tracks that he produced in his later period. But as an artist, his influence had become reduced. And, people were looking over his more recent work back to his early work. So yeah, by the time I got into music journalism, Bowie was basically a spent force in many ways. A spent force who was trying to kind of regenerate himself, though.
Who were some of the most notable interviews that you did?
I've interviewed quite a few over the years. I interviewed the band Sugar, which is Bob Mould of Husker Du. That was quite an interesting interview because I had absolutely no idea who he was at the time. And, I just turned up at the office and they said, do you want to interview this band? And I said, yeah, whatever. And who are they? And straight in without any preparation. That's how we used to do things in those days. We didn't have the internet as well. Nowadays, journalists have it easy. They have the internet. They can sort of do a lot of Googling, and it makes it a lot easier to know their subject. But in those days, we didn't have that. We had to kind of know the music or think fast on our feet.
You also interviewed the Prime Minister of Japan. How did you get that interview?
He's an ex-Prime Minister of Japan. But before going there, I should mention a few of the other musicians I've interviewed. I mean, I've interviewed the guys from Judas Priest, Rob Halford and Glenn Tipton, and I've interviewed a couple of guys out of Iron Maiden. And so the list is quite long if I start going into it, though. So the Prime Minister of Japan, that might surprise a few people. Also interviewed the head of the Communist Party over here as well. The Prime Minister of Japan, he was an ex-Prime Minister, Prime Minister Hosokawa. And, he's actually from a very noble family, a daimyo family. And so he's a very kind of cultured person. In his political retirement, he's sort of turned his attentions to art. And so through a kind of shared interest in art, I was able to hook up with him.
You did write an article about David Bowie for Countercurrents called Loving the Alien.
That's right, yeah. When a famous celebrity dies, suddenly it sort of takes over the media and the kind of Twitter and Facebook feeds. And so, there's a kind of sudden imperative to generate content. And so Greg asked me to come up with something. And, I've been kind of mulling an article on Bowie for a while, and I have actually written about him before. And this was a good opportunity to kind of like crunch my ideas together and come up with something a bit new.
So what are some of your ideas about Bowie that you would say are new ideas that haven't been covered by other music, by other fans or music critics?
In the Countercurrents article, Loving the Alien, I wanted to focus on his wider significance. Individual creativity and genius are very, very interesting things in their own right, but how does that relate to the wider society and the wider kind of flow of politics and social mood? And so I wanted to set Bowie in that kind of political and social context. As I went into that, it became very, very obvious what Bowie represented in that respect. And, the clue's almost in his dates of his birth and death, you know, because 1947, that's when he was born, and 2016, the current year, is when he died. And both of those years seem to be very relevant. 1947, in a British context, was a very important year because that was the year when the British Empire officially died, because the British Empire existed because of India and our colonial control of India. India became independent in 1947. So effectively that was the end of the British Empire. And then without that, without India, the rest of it kind of just shriveled up.
There are a few British colonies like the British Virgin Islands, but they're pretty small.
Well, yeah, there are a few scattered around the world. There's Gibraltar, which we still have. There's Pitcairn Island in the Pacific Ocean. There's, of course, the hard-won Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic, and a few other islands down there. There's also St. Helena and Ascension Island. And then there's Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, which is rented out to the American military. They have a major base there. So there's a few little bits and bobs around the world still.
So you were saying with Bowie, the significance, so he was born in that same year, but also what is the significance of this year, 2016?
Well, you know, it's still in the offing this year. We're not really sure what's going to happen, but it's sort of remarkable how things are moving already. I mean, last year we were very excited about Trump, and a lot of people thought this is great, but it's not going to last. And we've kind of seen the Trump challenge kind of firming up a lot, and now it's become a lot more credible.
Yeah, it looks he has a very good chance of winning. I mean, it's almost you never know, but I think he'll probably get the Republican nomination, and then once he gets a nomination, he'll probably have a good chance of winning. Obviously, things are changing dramatically in Europe too.
Yeah, exactly. Because the other thing that we've had in Britain, the post-imperial world kind of threw Britain into a bit of a quandary, and we had this kind of like awkward period in our history when we didn't really know, or we still don't, who we are. That's part of the reason why you see this kind of mass immigration, this multiculturalism. That's the result of confusion about identity, about purpose, about not knowing who you are and what your country exists for. We've been going through this kind of phase for decades now. Dean Acheson, this American politician, he kind of commented on that, and you know, Britain's lost an empire but is yet to find a role in the world. And in the 1960s, we kind of found a bit of a role with, we became this kind of cultural center, this center of soft power. and we still retained a lot of contacts in terms of, you know, financial clout with the City of London. And then in the 70s, you know, there was a lot of economic turbulence and confusion, and that kind of struck at Britain quite hard, I think. And then we sort of came out of that with Thatcherism, which was very polarizing and divided the nation. So it wasn't really a suitable solution. And so you've seen Britain kind of like slewing around from left to right, you know, not in a political sense, just in a kind of directionless sense. One of the main roles we've kind of assumed in this post-imperial world, we've thought, you know, we should be more part of Europe. And that's kind of become a bit of a consensus, at least in the political class. And for a long time, it was actually a consensus within most of the population. You know, people thought, you know, our future is in Europe, so we have to join the EU. And okay, we don't like a lot of the things the French do, and a lot of these silly rules that emanate from Brussels with our consent, of course. But we'll go along with these little inconveniences, and because that's where our future lies. That was the kind of consensus. And you know, gradually there's been a build-up of Euroscepticism, and it's sort of been bubbling under, and the political class have been trying to keep a lid on it. And but because it exists and it's very potent, it's allowed a party like UKIP to become very successful, certainly in things like the European elections, even though they still find it very, very difficult to break through at Westminster elections because of the peculiarities of the British electoral system. But, you know, the other thing is David Cameron, the Conservative leader, he has to be very careful about that, because his European flank is very vulnerable to attack by Eurosceptic forces, because his own party includes a kind of strong contingent of Eurosceptics. He's always had to throw them a bone. So we're going to have a referendum on whether we should remain members of the European Union. The thinking behind that is because, you know, when we joined the European Union in 1973, it was a much more limited kind of organization. Since then, it's kind of grown, and it's become more all-embracing, and it's started to have a bigger and bigger effect on people's lives. And it started to override the ability of British people to make their own laws. And so because the relationship has changed so much, the rationale is that it's now lacking a certain degree of political legitimacy, and therefore it needs to have its political legitimacy refreshed through a referendum. But the real reason, of course, is David Cameron knows that if he doesn't do that, UKIP are going to rip him wide open on his Euro flank, and you know, that could destroy the Conservative Party and let Labour in, or even let UKIP in. So it's sort of like it's basically just crafty politics having this Euro referendum. And you could draw an analogy with the Scottish independence referendum, because that again, there were similar forces building up in Scotland pushing for independence. And the way to deal with that is not to just blanketly deny them, but to acknowledge them to some degree and then try to deflect them. That's what they did quite successfully with the Scottish referendum. There was a very, very strong impetus towards independence, but they managed to head it off using a kind of mixture of bribery and threats. And the political establishment, they still believe in Britain being part of Europe, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, which I can go into later. They definitely believe in staying in Europe. And they thought they could handle this kind of Euroscepticism in a similar way to that in which they handled the push for Scottish independence. So they thought, yeah, we'll have a referendum. We'll have the media entirely on our side. We'll have all the business leaders talking about how leaving the EU will destroy the economy. And so we'll threaten people, and then we'll try to get some concessions from the EU to bribe people as well. And then the voters, by a narrow margin, will probably decide to stay in the EU. That's the game plan. I just want to emphasize the 2016 part of the equation there, because you know they were hoping to contain this Euroscepticism, and that's kind of been a little bit blown out of the water by the migrant crisis. So, you know, on balance, it kind of now looks like, you know, there will be a vote probably this year, and there's a very strong likelihood now that Britain will vote to leave the EU. And so 2016, like 1947, becomes a very kind of watershed year in British history. And it kind of perfectly kind of bookends this period of post-imperial confusion with which David Bowie's life, you know, neatly coincides.
Would you say he's very much symbolic of England?
Well, yeah, you see him as British because, you know, of his misaligned teeth and his way of speaking and his rather aristocratic demeanor. That's why Americans see him as quintessentially English. He sort of fits in with a lot of your kind of cliched views of England. And I kind of see him as English in the sense of being very confused about who you are. And, you know, this is the essence of Bowie. He's a kind of shapeshifter, a chameleon, a man who, you know, throughout his career donned one mask after another. And, you know, that's sort of like how Britain looks to me as well. You know, like if I look back over the kind of social history of Britain, you see almost the same kind of thing. You know, you have the Cool Britannia period, you have the Thatcher period, you have this swinging 60s Britain, you have the kind of let's be good Europeans Britain. So it's this constant chopping and changing and not knowing who you really are.
I think Bowie does stand out as timeless. A lot of musicians are stereotypically seen with a decade, like the Beatles are associated with the 60s. But Bowie's not really, even though he was most active in the 70s, because he has such a unique sound, he's not stereotyped with a certain decade.
Well, I think that this whole idea, we've kind of grown up with this whole idea of, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, whatever, you know, that's out of date now, I have to say. That sort of ties into certain liberal notions of progress. You know, you have one decade succeeding the other, and each decade has its distinctive style, and it's seen as more progressive than the previous decade. And I think we've kind of lost that kind of sense of, I mean, it certainly happened with the last few decades. I mean, the 90s was a bit crap. And then we've had this kind of this lost decade of the zeros. What does this
mean? There's been sort of a cultural stagnation where from the 50s to the 80s, each decade had a very distinct, unique culture.
Yeah, and not just one. I mean, if you look at some of the past decades, there were several key cultures in each decade. I mean, you had this kind of like glam rock in the early 70s, and that kind of mutated into punk rock and disco and stuff like that. You know, so you had very, very distinct cultural movements and flavors in just one decade. And now you don't get that anymore. And a lot of it's to do with the way the media has changed, but also it's to do with a sense of cultural exhaustion. And what's happened now is there's sort of now like a kind of super decade, which exists in a kind of timeless cultural space. And that kind of super decade, it kind of embraces the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s.
And they're constantly trying to copy previous styles, like come up with a new version of something from the past, but there's not really anything new or innovative in the last 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, basically our culture has sort of done a U-turn, and we're kind of hovering over this historical super decade of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We can see that in the way that they're making movies now. I mean, like Star Wars, that's 70s culture being recycled, really. And the music's like that. Everything in music is regurgitated. It's a pastiche. It's all been done before. Actual new creative cutting edge music that is entirely original is, I guess, it's just kind of disappeared.
I noticed with decades, like both the 60s and the 80s were the decade where England probably had the strongest impact on music.
Yeah, the 60s and the 80s. Yeah, there's a slight downturn in the 70s, probably.
Or that's sort of ironic because that's when Bowie was most active, in the 70s.
Yeah, because even though Bowie, even though British musical influence was very strong in the 70s, it didn't have the same kind of impact that it did in the 60s. And then with the 80s, I guess you're probably referring to a lot of the bands that came over and had a big impact through MTV in the 80s.
Would you say that a new wave is seen as a uniquely like British style?
You can't really say that, but it's sort of dominated by a certain kind of British sensibility. It certainly has a certain kind of slightly fascistic feel, which echoes some of the kind of cultural strands that were going on in Britain at the time.
The conservative establishment, like Thatcher, she really idolized Churchill, so in a sense, fascist imagery was seen as being kind of counterculture. Even Bowie kind of flirted with it, too.
That's how I've always seen it, this kind of Nazi affectation that a lot of the British bands had in the 70s. I mean, just to list the examples, the Sex Pistols, they played around with swastika imagery. You had bands like Joy Division and Spear of Destiny, another great band. There was even a band, Mick Jones of The Clash, a Jewish member of The Clash, his musical career started in London SS. And being a bit fash in those days was a way of sticking up a middle finger at the conservative Churchillian establishment.
Well, Bowie made some comment, and this was in the 70s, he said something like Hitler was like the ultimate rock star.
Yeah, that's one of his kind of famous quotes. I think that's from his 1976 Playboy interview, which was quite a good one to mine for interesting quotes. Now, I think Bowie, he liked to, I mean, he was like the Donald Trump of rock music, really. He knew how to put something out there that the media would then kind of like react or overreact to, and then that would boost his profile. And so he did that quite a lot. He did that with his fashions, of course, with his gender bending fashions. At that time, that was very, very shocking, of course, because people were, people still are very socially conservative, but in those days they were, they used to project their social conservatism. Nowadays, they kind of like feel a little bit inhibited about their social conservatism. But that's not going to last either. So I think with Bowie, the pattern that emerges is, we did a podcast on the alt-right with Anne Sturzinger and Andy, of course. And one of the things we talked about was, how Bowie was effectively a kind of proto-troll, even before the internet.
Yeah, because that troll culture, it's a relatively recent phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I guess there was sort of a precursor to that was like the shock jocks and radio, but there wasn't. That was basically it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I'm not too familiar with your American shock jocks, but the basic.
The best example of that would be Howard Stern.
Yeah,
he was kind of the original troll, but he did it just with kind of like crude sexual stuff.
Yeah, I vaguely know this guy, but I'm more familiar with Rush Limbaugh because in the past I used to listen to the American Services Radio over here, and he was always on.
And what Bowie was noted for is his interview style, where he was very kind of confrontational towards the interviewers.
He could be, yeah, not always. I mean, I think it was case by case. I think if the interviewer was sympathetic and slightly fawning, then Bowie would be a bit more forthcoming. But if the interviewer was trying to get on top, then Bowie would see that as a clash of wills, and then he would start to employ a wide array of passive-aggressive techniques and try to belittle his opponent. I guess the classic example of that is the Russell Harty interview, which you can easily find on YouTube.
Another thing that was unique about him is he was before like music videos. He was the first musician to really he was also like a visual artist. So his songs is very much he put on a show and he's told a story. And this predated the music videos.
Yeah. I think what we're dealing with here is the difference between American and British music industry economics. Now, in America, you know, you have this massive country and it's, you know, there's all these cities hundreds of miles apart. And so to succeed in America is a very difficult task from succeeding in the UK. UK is a much more densely populated, London-centered entity. And so, you know, in the British market, everybody's much more in direct competition. With America, it's more about the touring. I mean, to break in America, typically they say you have to go on the road, you have to hit all these cities, and then you have to come back and hit them again. And then gradually you build up the name recognition, and then things will kick off. And so in America, it's always been about the footwork, really, you know, in musical terms, and just getting your ass to the next town and putting on a good show. In Britain, by contrast, it's much more about direct competition, and therefore image comes into it a lot more. And I think we see this really, you know, very, very clearly in the rise of glam rock. You know, I mean, glam rock really took off in Britain because you had these bands directly competing against each other and seeking to get more attention. And so British musicians were much more kind of visually aware than American musicians. And that's what kind of fed into, you know, as you mentioned before about the 80s, that meant when British bands again kind of swept into America. And, you know, that was through the medium of MTV. So British bands were much better adapted to the new medium of MTV. And that gave them a big advantage in the 80s.
You were making a comment. You said his personality and creative style has a Nietzschean quality to it.
Yeah. I mean, Bowie, when you look at all the different things throughout his career, read his biographies or autobiographies or, you know, things that people have written about him, it seems kind of clear that he's a very ambitious and driven individual. You know, he's always pushing. He's always banging on the door. He's always trying different things. And he has this very strong will to fame rather than will to power. You know, because will to power was not an option in the in the 1960s and the 1970s in Britain. And so instead, Bowie developed this will to fame. I mean, if he'd been born in the, you know, like 50 years before, who knows, he might have been an Oswald Mosley type of character. Of course, now you could speculate about what drove that. It could just be a sense of nihilism, you know, like Bowie was obviously very intelligent, and so for somebody like him and living when he did, it might have been very, very hard to actually believe in anything spiritual or greater than himself. So there would be a sense of nihilism and a need to fill the void. And so
there is something kind of otherworldly about his music that you don't get that often from music.
What are you referring to exactly? Because when you say otherworldly, people are going to think, oh yeah, spiders from Mars and Moon Age Daydream and Ground Control to Major Tom, you know. But you're not talking about space exploration, are you?
Well, that gets into it, but I guess it creates very, very much kind of draws you in.
Mm-hmm. So you're maybe talking in a slightly more abstract sense about his kind of more transcendent qualities.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. With Bowie. Bowie, again, the interesting thing about Bowie, he has this kind of art school or art rock kind of sensibility. And that kind of shows through in his lyrics, and his lyrics are very kind of poetic in the sense that you're not really sure what they mean, but they kind of resonate, and they...
Well, like Space Odyssey tells a story, but a lot of his lyrics are very kind of obtuse and abstract.
Yes, they can elicit various things from various people. They can operate like Rorschach blotches. And so you can, you know, everybody's going to hear those lyrics, and you're going to pick out certain lyrics more than others because, you know, they speak to you personally. And so it's really hard to say what his real message is. And I think he's trying to put a range of ideas out there, a smorgasbord of ideas out there, and then people just come along and pick up whichever ones reinforce their own sense of who they are.
And I guess different people have their own personal interpretation or relationship with David Bowie.
Yeah, that's exactly what I kind of just said there, yeah. But yeah, that's much clearer than the way I put it. So everybody reads Bowie in their own way, except for, you know, Space Oddity, which is a very clear-cut story about an astronaut getting into trouble.
Can you give some, like, specific examples of how different types of fans would take that and use that to create their own identity?
Okay, let's see now. Let's have a look. We've got... I'm going to dig up my hunky dory sleeve notes here. Let's see. Oh, Life on Mars. I've always liked that song. You can just read through it. Let's see. It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, but her mummy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go. But her friend is nowhere to be seen as she walks through her sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen, etc. I mean, you're going to pick out different things. I mean, there's a theme about a girl, mousy hair, so this girl lacks confidence. So a girl might start to read that in a kind of slightly more feminist way. And then if you go deeper into the song, sailors fighting in the dance hall, oh man, look at those cavemen go, it's the freakiest show. Take a look at the lawman beating up the wrong guy. Okay, that's going to really appeal to social justice warriors. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know, he's in the best-selling show, Is There Life on Mars? And then we've got other lyrics which share. Rule Britannia is out of bounds to my mother, my dog and clowns. A lyric like that might speak to somebody who's more interested in political collapse and exhaustion.
What have been some of the reactions from the alternative right? Has they mostly focused on his work, or has there been some political responses too?
Well, depends what you mean by the alternative right, but because I think most of the people who write for the alternative right are kind of quite cultured and urbane, and but a lot of our commenters have sort of focused on his degeneracy and his faggotry.
But that seems to be the case. A lot of commentators are saying that because they're saying he's a degenerate, we should write him off. But I think that is true of a lot of creative types. I think creativity and degeneracy often go together.
Well, if you're a rock star and you have extremely beautiful women constantly throwing themselves at you, it's going to be pretty hard to be a sackcloth and ashes kind of monk type.
But what is their definition? I guess it depends how one defines degeneracy. Everyone has their own definition.
Well, I think there is a very simple definition of degeneracy. Degeneracy implies degeneration, which implies a lower than survival rate, reproductive rate. Bowie had two children. One of them was of mixed race. So I guess he's a bit of a degenerate.
But as I said, different people have their own definition. By that definition, someone could have like 10 kids, but may have do other activities.
Yeah,
I'm sure there've been plenty of historical figures who have fit that category.
Yeah, well, I think you can actually be very precise about the use of words, and I'd say like now, what's the replacement rate? I think it's 2.14 kids who actually are the same race as you. That would be generacy, and higher than that would be extra generacy, and less than that would be degeneracy. So that's
so you're saying that's
I'm sticking to that definition.
That's a technical one, but I guess people use that word just to describe behavior they personally find distasteful.
Well, you can also say that Bowie's a cultural figure, and therefore he promotes a certain kind of social mood. And that social mood then influences other people's birth rate. So, you know, you could say that one thing about Bowie is, the androgyny, the emphasis on being who you are, this kind of hyper-individualism, like, you know, even though you're a freak, just be yourself because, there's nothing wrong with being a freak. Now, all that could lead to degeneracy on a social level. So you could say certain things associated with his music and with the culture that he's promoting led to degeneracy and may have facilitated homosexuality and so forth. So in that sense, you could say he's culturally degenerate, and that's a possible argument, and it could be valid in certain cases, I would say.
But you also made the point there's a sort of fascistic element too.
But it's sort of it's very narcissistic. I think it's all about being the Superman then on an individual basis, and in that sense it is degenerate because I think individualism itself is degenerate because once we become defined as individuals, then we become mortal. And, you know, you see this with a lot of Bowie's late work. You know, he is really contemplating the end, and it's all about the last album and the one before that. What was that called? I'm trying to remember. Yeah, The Next Day and Black Star. They're kind of suffused with a sense of death. And a lot of that comes from the fact that, you know, Bowie, although very, very Nietzschean, and a kind of Superman in his own way, he wasn't so in a group sense. He wasn't part of a greater collective. And, of course, you could say maybe, you know, living when he did, he didn't really have that option. But then again, that sounds like you're making excuses for the guy. But he's very, very focused on himself. And so there is a kind of narcissistic sense to his kind of Übermensch quality.
Would you say that's true of people who are innovators and who come up with their own unique identity? Very few people are like that. Most people adopt their identity off of someone else. I mean, most prominent musicians copy their style from someone else. There's only like a small handful. And he's one of the few who has a truly like distinct style.
Yeah, well, you know, again, you can say that, you know, he's born at the right time, you know, because a lot of the things that Bowie got into would not have been possible earlier. And then later, it would have been too late, you know what I mean? So you couldn't actually do all that kind of shocking people by being a bit androgynous now. But then again, if he had tried that in the 1950s or the 1930s, it would have probably ended in a very unpleasant way. Or he would have just been marginalized, sidelined, and ignored. But, you know, he kind of got into what he got into at the optimum time. So you could see it as a case of Bowie coming along and having all the low-hanging fruit to pick.
So you said in the 70s he basically kind of set the standard and other people emulated him. Your argument with 80s Bowie is that he was influenced more by the general style than come up with a unique style.
It was, Andy and Anne and my consensus in the podcast we did.
Andy was saying that he likes the 80s Bowie more than you do, but he still thinks that your point was valid to a degree.
Yeah. It's just Andy's just got atrocious taste in music. What can I say? No, I think Andy's sort of referring to the way that we are kind of imprinted with music. It's a bit like the baby ducklings kind of effect. You know, the first thing they see is mama. When you're a teenager, and you hear music, you kind of imprint on a lot of the music. It's just there when you're ready for it. And even if it's crap, then that'll be the thing you like. There's a certain degree of truth to that idea. But I think, of course, quality counts for a lot as well.
He's not easy to put into one sort of musical genre. He's not completely punk, but he's not completely new wave.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of hard to define as a genre. Because he has his own style.
Well, Bowie's just very talented and very kind of eclectic and very intelligent, and so this is what you would kind of expect from somebody like him. And you know, he's also a good collaborator. So we always talk about Bowie as if he's one person, but I mean, musically, Bowie includes quite a few other people. I mean, Mick Ronson was really important in the kind of early Bowie albums, which are basically his best albums. And then later, he kind of, I think he started to experience a bit of a decline in creativity towards the later part of the 70s, or even from the mid 70s.
I don't necessarily agree that. I think that he's more influenced by other styles, but I wouldn't go as far as to say his stuff lacks creativity. A lot of the stuff from the 80s is still pretty good.
Which albums are you referring to here? There's Let's Dance, 1983, Tonight, 1984, then Never Let Me Down, that's 1987, and then there's The Tin Machine, I think, 88 to 92, 93, he did Black Tie, White Noise.
And then, I don't know if I've heard his 90s, I don't know if I've listened to his 90s stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, basically, when you're talking about 80s Bowie, mainly people are talking about Let's Dance and sometimes Scary Monsters and Super Creeps, which is like bang on 1980.
So in your article, you actually do get into the one on Countercurrents. You get into his different albums. The argument you make is that his 80s albums, they do reflect sort of the culture of the era.
Yes, yeah, I think in the 80s, what we have in the West, especially in America and Britain, we have this this rise of neoliberalism and kind of yuppie culture, and in a kind of very weird way, you know, Bowie's work kind of tacks strongly in that direction. And it becomes much more Americanized, and he sort of moves away from this kind of Berlin period where he was kind of infatuated with this kind of pseudo-totalitarian kind of Cold War wasteland.
You're saying one of his songs, the one China Girl, you're saying it glamorizes Red China?
Well, yeah, in a way, yeah, because I think in the late 70s, Bowie was getting it in the neck for you know, being a bit of a fascist. And then I think one of the motivations behind, I mean, China Girl was actually written around about the period when Bowie was being castigated for being a fascist. I think it's from 1977. I think what happened with Let's Dance, they decided to put the song on the album, but they decided to repackage it with a video that sort of, you know, in a sense, sort of celebrated the iconography of communist China. And so Bowie was trying to kind of offset some of the accusations made about his fascist affectations.
Well, there's obviously a reference to swastikas in the lyrics.
Yeah, and he's saying, oh, I just what he's basically saying is, oh, swastikas, communists, Red China, totalitarian this, totalitarian that. Why are you getting down on me? So he's basically just trying to say, I'm just playing with imagery. I'm just playing with fascism as a concept, with communism as a concept. I'm not really a fascist. I'm not really a communist. I'm a neo-yuppie.
Yeah, that was also a controversy with Pink Floyd. Like they used fascist imagery, but they were saying that they were against fascism, but they still attacked.
Yeah, that was much more clear cut.
Roger Waters. Yeah, then they also did this thing in their show where they had a plane dropping. Well, they dropped like the signs of capitalism, the dollar sign, and the symbols of Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. So they definitely play with symbols.
Yeah, yeah. I think with the Wall album, I think the Wall album was 1979. And that scene has a kind of an anti-fascist album, and that is much more clear-cut.
But Bowie never has a clear message. In his case, he just sort of plays with symbolism.
That's right, yeah. But in the late 70s, because of certain incidents and because of certain interviews, people started to think, wait a minute, this guy really might be a fascist. And I think Bowie was very attracted to fascism because he is a kind of a Nietzschean type. He is somebody who's living in this kind of post-spiritual world, and he's trying to find meaning, and he's trying to find that meaning through creativity and through achieving things on a personal level and through constant self-improvement. So he's a very kind of highly disciplined person and a very ambitious person. And so in that sense, he's a bit of a fashy type. And so, of course, it would be natural for somebody like that to find, you know, Nazism and the story of Hitler fascinating. I'm pretty sure he did. But then to sort of read that kind of historical interest and definition of his personality into having a kind of neo-Nazi agenda, that is a kind of leap that I don't think Bowie ever made or would have made.
What do you think about his movie Labyrinth? I know Anne Sturzinger had that post on her wall. Like,
oh no, I'm not gonna say anything about. I haven't really. I know of it. I don't think I've ever seen it though.
I've seen it. Well, I haven't seen it since I was a kid, but I have a recollection of it. But Anne Sturzinger kind of joked in her wall, "How many people jerked off to that movie this week?"
Yeah, well, you'll have to ask Anne about that. I can't really help you.
That was definitely, well, that he did the soundtrack for that, so that was kind of, that was 80s, but that came out maybe like 85 or 86, so that was after he was most active in the early 80s.
Yeah, at that time you kind of see Bowie kind of losing interest in music to a certain degree. I mean, yeah, very, very, all these things are relative to a certain degree. And he moves more strongly towards other forms of expression. And then he becomes much more.
He did acting, but he's also a painter.
Yeah, yeah. So he becomes very active as an actor and, as you say, a painter. And that's, I think he, around about, you know, Let's Dance and then going into the next album after that, which kind of, 1984's Tonight album, which got a mauling from the critics. At that point, Bowie sort of starts to lose a little bit of his faith in music, and he also becomes more aware of other possibilities, because movies, TV. I guess in the 90s, he starts to see the rise of the internet, and he starts to think about those other avenues of creation. But also, he goes into painting. I've seen a lot of his paintings, and well, they're not really the sort of thing I tend to like, I have to say. I'll reserve judgment to another time. But, yeah, I think that's all indicative of the downturn in his musical career.
What do you think of the song that's inspired by Space Odyssey, Major Tom by Peter Schilling?
No, I don't know that song, to be honest. Peter Schilling. Who is Peter Schilling?
Oh, you mentioned it in your podcast.
Was it me or was it Andy or Anne?
Oh, it must have been
It'll probably be Anne.
Andy.
Or Andy, yeah. No, I don't know that. I don't know who Peter Schilling is. Is he some American singer?
No, he's a German, but he did a song. This was in the early 80s, but it was inspired by. It's interesting because he did this song when Bowie got really his 80s career started, so they kind of coincided with each other, but it was inspired by his earliest, one of his like first major hits.
Yeah, I'm just sort of Googling Peter Schilling now, and yeah, it's a Major Tom in brackets Coming Home. It's a song by Peter Schilling from his album Error in the System, with a character unofficially related to Major Tom, the theme of David Bowie's Space Oddity. Yeah, I mean, I've never heard of this album. It's an obscure West German album, from what I can tell.
It's not obscure. It's a pretty well-known song.
UK singles charts number 42. It did quite well in America, I see. It got up to number 10 in the Cashbox Top 100. So it did better in America than it did in Britain. In Britain, it kind of sank without a trace, I guess.
So Germany was also trying to emulate the kind of the style of England at the time too.
Yeah, well, German popular culture is a weird one. Yeah, it's a lot of German musicians and bands basically take their cue from Britain and America.
There were a number of major German bands in that. I think the genre is called something like Neue Deutsche Welle.
Yeah, there's the krautrock thing, you know, which was not exactly chart topping, you know, but it was influential in other ways. Kraftwerk, a lot of their music was easy to sample because it's so kind of clean and precise and Germanic. It makes it easier for black people to sample it, and so it a lot of that cropped up later in hip hop. And that's given it a certain kind of, critical kudos now, which, I don't really rate krautrock as much as most people seem to.
What else do you want to cover before I wrap up? Like, what other topics do you want to cover that I didn't touch upon?
I think we've had a far-ranging talk already. I mean, if there's any more questions you care to ask, we can finish with one or two more questions.
So, what impact and influence did David Bowie have on other artists since him?
I think a lot of people have kind of ripped him off in various ways, but there are kind of obvious people that have sort of followed in his footsteps. I mean, a band like Suede in England, for example, one of the Britpop bands in the 90s, they're very Bowie-esque. If you look around, you'll be able to find some elements of influence in almost everybody. As I was saying, you know, what we have now, we have this kind of super decade of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, which has kind of coagulated into this giant cultural space that our contemporary culture is constantly hovering over. And so anybody today who's making music is going to be like, listen to a bit of Bowie and like pinching this idea or that idea or this image thing. You know what I mean? So I think Bowie kind of suffuses our culture rather than, you know, saying, oh, he influenced artist A or artist B.
And one more thing you said. You mentioned that since England didn't have a space program like the U.S. and Soviet Union did, he kind of filled that void.
Yeah, it's kind of very noticeable because you have not just Bowie, but, you know, very important bands like Pink Floyd and Hawkwind. They had that whole kind of space aesthetic. A part of that is probably a religious thing as well, because I think another kind of important difference between America and Britain is Britain's much more post-Christian than America. America's still sort of semi-post-Christian. And so there's much more a kind of spiritual void in Britain. People tend to fill the spiritual void in very offbeat and interesting ways. One thing that people mention is this sort of Greenpeace mentality where things like dolphins and whales and the environment become a kind of substitute god. And you also see this with this kind of UFO cult.
Also, one of his songs, Starman, is about aliens coming down to meet humans.
Yeah, it's like, with Starman's quite an interesting song because it's very un-Nietzschean, I'd have to say. Because a Nietzschean song would be about us going into space and becoming the Starman. And with the song Starman, it's about us being weak, feeble beings, bound to the earth, and then some mighty superior being coming down to make contact with us. And there were several films in the 70s which explored that kind of territory. I mean, E.T. and so on.
And Ziggy Stardust starts off as a space odyssey of a dying earth, so that sort of at that time it was really the beginning of the whole sort of concern of an ecological collapse.
Yeah, let's just pull out the sleeve notes to 5 years. Pushing through the market square, so many mothers sighing, etc., etc. Now, we're not really sure from the lyrics what the reason for the 5 years is. It says, we've got 5 years. What a surprise. We've got 5 years. My brain hurts a lot. We've got 5 years. That's all we've got. But he doesn't actually say specifically why we have 5 years. So to read that, again, this is an example of, Bowie's lyrics existing as Rorschach blotches, because nowadays, we have this ecological stuff rammed down our throats 24/7. And so, of course, looking at this song in 2016, the current year, we're going to see, oh, wow, Bowie, what an ecological guy he was. But in 1972 or whenever it appeared, I don't think people would necessarily see this as an ecological song. If you think about the 70s, they're much more likely to see that as a prophecy of nuclear Armageddon.
And he was never, as interesting, you were saying about it, like with symbolism, was he ever involved with politics himself?
Like, as in vote for me or I endorse X candidate?
It seems like most musicians, prominent musicians, are to some degree.
Well, I think Bowie was smart enough to know that would really that wouldn't go anywhere, and it would make him look a bit naff. There's a kind of an element of sneering in Bowie's persona, of kind of like looking down a little bit at things, and being a bit superior to all. And when you start endorsing politicians, you start to sound a little bit bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and naive. And I don't think Bowie would ever want to sound like that.
Well, he definitely gave off like an aristocratic air. But what's interesting is he was from like a working-class Cockney background.
Yeah. I think his mother had some Irish blood, and his father, he actually worked for a charity. I guess you'd say he was kind of upper working class or lower middle class background.
Did he grow up in London?
Yeah, in South London, in a part of London that has been completely ethnically cleansed, we could say.
So this whole sort of a Cockney identity, it's in a sense, is becoming extinct.
Yeah, it's been pushed out of London in a lot of cases. There's a lot of the former Cockney population has been pushed out beyond the suburban belt into places in Essex.
So where? How would you? So you were originally from Scotland, but you lived in London most of your life.
No. I lived in. I haven't lived anywhere most of my life.
Yeah, I noticed your accent is kind of. It's kind of difficult to define. It's kind of a hodgepodge of different stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A man of mystery. I'm a shapeshifter like Bowie.
You don't really sound like your accent is not like stereotypically Scottish.
No, actually, it has elements of London I've noticed. But that all evaporates as soon as I go north of the border.
Are you going to start trying to pick up a Japanese accent?
No, of course not. No, the good thing about living in these exotic countries is it kind of reinforces your own original identity, which you might otherwise lose living in a kind of homogenous environment.
So, before I wrap up the show, is there anything else you'd like to add about any of these topics?
We'll save it for the next podcast.
Okay. Colin Liddell, thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you, Robert. Interesting talking to you as always.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.